Questions? So we've been talking about, yes.
On the last assignment for the solar sailing, you said 100% reflectivity. Does that mean the sail needs to be half or it needs to be twice as much?
So the initial momentum of the light will produce twice as much momentum in the sail because it's going to bounce back.
Right. Okay.
More questions? So I haven't bothered to correct the most recent homeworks, but I do have them for lots of people.
Wait, what did you just say? What was your response to the initial momentum of the light?
So the initial momentum of the light is going to produce twice that momentum in the sail, right? Because it's going to bounce back. So we've been talking about radiation, which just means radio waves or whatever. And this is, we never proved this formula. It's kind of a mess to prove, but it is a very helpful formula for figuring out what's going on with light. So first of all, it depends on acceleration, which reminds you that accelerating charge is exactly what produces light. And we've seen a couple of applications of that. So with light scattering off of a free electron, the light makes the electron undergo a simple harmonic motion, and then that produces scattered light, so-called regenerated light by that formula. And we found out that the effective cross-section of an electron was comparable to the size of a nucleus, the so-called classical electron radius. And then last time what we looked at is kind of why the sky is blue question. If we think about the electrons being attached to air molecules by springs, it turns out that the spring, the natural frequency of those electrons, is higher than the visible frequency of light. So we're in a low omega sort of situation. And under that situation, the displacement is kind of instantaneously adjusting itself to the electric field. So we have this relationship between the displacement of the electron and the electric field of the light. And if we know what x is, we can take two derivatives of it to get what the acceleration is. So we've got an acceleration that's proportional to omega squared, which means the scattered light is going to be proportional to omega to the fourth. So this is Rayleigh scattering, and it means that high frequency light, like blue light, is going to be scattered 10 times more frequently than red light is, for example. And that explains why the sky is blue. So then we went on to talk about at least as a starting point, things like antennas. And the example we're going to deal with eventually is about the simplest sort of antenna we can imagine. We've got a short segment of wire that is carrying some current I, and of course the current has to be the same through every piece of this wire. And that means that at the end of this wire, charge is accumulating, and at the other end of this wire, charge is being depleted. And this current is going to be oscillating. So we actually have an oscillating dipole where we have positive charge up top, negative below, and then it will reverse itself with some frequency. So this is the problem we wanted to solve. How much light is going to be radiated from this pretty simple antenna? And the starting point is to switch to potentials as opposed to fields. And these two Maxwell's equations are going to be automatically satisfied when we write things in terms of potentials. And these two equations turn out to look pretty simple and exactly the same if we're in what's called the Lorentz gauge. So in the past, we had no time dependence, so there is no time derivative of voltage, and we had the divergence of B being zero. Now we have exactly this combination. And if we choose that combination, then these two equations have pretty simple form, where we just have the source, either current or charge, being the D'Alembertian, which is just kind of like the Laplacian, except for including time too, for the A field and the phi field. And we see here the start of four vectors, putting together three normal vectors and something else to make four components, which is going to be an important part of relativity. We didn't prove it, and it's kind of a mess to prove, but the solution to this equation is pretty simple. And before, when we had time-independent things, We just didn't have any time here, and we just had the current divided by the distance integrated up. So now, if we have time dependence, then we want the current, not now, but what the current was like in the past when light could have reached us. So that's called the retarded time. Take the current time and subtract off the time it would have taken light to have reached you. And mathematically, that has a real important consequence. It now means that there are two places where there's an r. And of course, we're going to be taking derivatives of r all the time when we do this process. So there's going to be an r here, and there's going to be an r that's hidden in the retarded time. And that's really critical, because if we only had r's here, when we took derivatives of this to get fields, we would get fields that went like 1 over r squared. And that would mean pointing vectors, which are e cross h, that go like 1 over r to the fourth. And that would mean under ever larger spheres, which have surface area that's proportional to r squared, there'd be less and less stuff. Light wouldn't radiate to infinity. It would all stay pretty close to the antenna. So the fact that there's another place to take derivatives with respect to r, so we can end up with fields that are only going like 1 over r, and therefore pointing vectors that go like 1 over r squared, and therefore the same amount of energy going through any size sphere that you want to talk about, then we have propagation to infinity. Okay, so kind of mathematically, the source of light is the presence of this retarded time. We didn't have that retarded time in here, we wouldn't have light that would carry energy through ever larger spheres. Okay, so this is a particularly easy setup where the current is just doesn't depend on z and has a sinusoidal variation, and we could pretty easily integrate this up. Now, what do we do with this r minus r prime? And this has to do with a series of kind of approximations that, you know, we don't seem to be particularly consistent about. Sometimes we will say that r minus r prime is pretty much just r, because we're thinking about this antenna being a pretty small object. Sometimes we do a little bit better, and we realize that r minus r prime, which is this green vector, is actually a little bit shorter than the red vector according to this value of z times cosine theta. So we use this approximation when it helps us, and we ignore it when it doesn't help us. And, you know, take some experience to see which you need to do. Of course, you can always carry the full terms. They just start to get messy. So the result of this was that, and again, all we did is go and calculate these quantities. The result of this was that the radial component of the electric field falls off like 1 over r squared, and so it's not going to be contributing to any long-term propagation. The theta component of the electric field, which is tangential to the radial direction, which is where the light is going, and you know that for light, the electric and magnetic fields are tangential. So under these circumstances, the theta component of the electric field is just falling off like 1 over r, and there's no phi component to the electric field. And no radial component to B, no theta component to B, but the phi component of B falls off like 1 over r. So again, combining these two things, we get a S vector, which falls off like 1 over r squared. So there's the same amount of power that's going through any sphere that you name, and that power is given by this formula. So it may look like as we let lambda go to zero, we're getting more and more power, but I remind you that part of this approximation was that lambda was big compared to the size of the antenna. So in fact, this quantity is always going to be fractional. So the upshot of all of these sort of calculations is what's called the radiation resistance. And generally, we think of resistance as being a bad thing, right? It's where energy is being converted into heat, usually not a useful form. This energy is leaving the circuit, but it's not leaving in the form of heat. It's leaving in the form of light. And so radiation resistance in this sense is a good thing, right? Usually, you want your antenna to radiate. Earlier, you had calculated just kind of in terms of units what this quantity was, mu divided by epsilon naught, and you got, I don't know, 377 ohms or something like that. And these numbers are all kind of typical. For almost any antenna you're going to talk about, you're going to have these radiation resistances that are on the order of 100 or 1,000 ohms. So from that, if you know what the current is, you should be able to calculate what the corresponding energy that's radiated. Okay, and I guess it's also useful to look at the directionality of this light. So these things all have terms that are sine of theta, which means if we're going on the z-axis where theta equals 0, or the negative z-axis where theta equals 180 degrees, there's not going to be any light in that direction. So if this is the dipole, the light is coming off in the more or less in the equator. No light is going up or down from this accelerating charge. Up or down? So the book at this point goes on to do the kind of the next order approximation to think about wavelengths that are comparable in size to the antenna. And that's usually how you actually make antennas. Antennas usually are a quarter of a wavelength or a half of a wavelength. They're very comparable in size to a wavelength. And I don't know, it's kind of a mess to do. I don't intend to do it. But the upshot is pretty similar. You get some radiation resistance that's, in this case, a few hundred ohms, if I recall correctly. Questions about radiation? So it depends, right? Because radios have a tremendous range of frequencies. So the radio that is in your Wi-Fi system is in gigahertz. And so those wavelengths are, you know, maybe about that big or so. If we're talking about AM radio, 10 on the AM radio dial is actually 1 megahertz. So then we're talking about wavelengths that are kilometers, if I recall correctly. For the FM dial, where we have 100 megahertz, then we're talking about meter scale wavelengths. And you know, even though it seems kind of crazy to think about it, because quantum mechanics is going to play an important role, I mean, you can think about atoms as being little antennas and what their frequency and size is. And turns out that this is not a terrible approximation for atoms. The size of an atom is much smaller than a wavelength of light. So we can use these sorts of approximations in order to get a handle on how atoms might radiate. Incidentally, things do become more complicated for nuclear radiations, where the wavelength, again, the energies are a lot bigger, so the wavelengths are shorter. And it turns out under those circumstances, then the wavelength and the source can start to have comparable sizes again. So when you have a choice, you usually construct your antenna to be have a size that's related to the wavelength. It's hard to do with AM radio because it's so huge, but for FM radio, definitely. And for television, which is pretty much, well, channels 1 through 12, which are basically the same as FM. Questions? Going, gone from radiation. So, the other thing to talk about was on my list to talk about, and no one added to my list, so, was relativity. So Alex's favorite question for me to ask is, what do you remember about relativity? You should remember lots. There were equations, and you learned them. Relativity.
Is this the twin problem?
It could include the twin problem.
Remember the twin problem?
Yeah.
I actually couldn't remember something. So that's about cool. It.
So there were gammas, right? So what? Yes. 1 over the square root of 1 minus beta squared. What's beta? V over C. So beta is something that is small, and since you can't go faster than the speed of light, it's less than 1. And for normal sorts of objects, beta is going to be a thousandth, a 10,000th, something pretty small. Gamma, on the other hand, when beta is equal to 0, goes to 1. And as beta goes to 1, this can get arbitrarily large as beta goes to 1. What else do we remember about relativity? I heard twin, but what else? Well, yeah, we got frames of reference, S and S prime, all of that sort of stuff. There must be more relativity than this. I'm sure you had that guy. You had that guy before you did anything. The most famous equation that is also wrong.
Somebody quoted you on Facebook as saying that. Some of your 106 series.
You heard me say it again.
They were studying for their test and they posted a picture of all of them, like, miserable in the library, and they said they were talking about curtains also. It's wrong, but.
How about things like Lorentz contraction? That's the meter. That's that you can fit your pole in your closet if it's going fast enough. Something about what?
Yeah.
Yes. Time dilation, that's what's behind kind of the twin paradox. So time dilation is that moving clocks run slow, at least when viewed from the outside. And Lorentz contraction was that meter sticks seem to be a lot shrunken. Okay, so what we've established is that you don't remember anything from modern, I think. Okay. What's that? It's a V. It's not a vector. If you go down one flight of stairs, you want to tell them that this is a tensor. Because they have a very simple idea of what a vector is, right? They have a whole course called linear algebra where they deal with vector spaces, and most anything could be a vector, right? So we had functions as vectors. But tensors, which is what mathematicians would call vectors, are more complicated things. And in particular, what they have that the vectors of vector spaces don't have is they have some sort of transformation properties. And that was, you know, really useful and important. I think I said this all last time. Useful and important in 191, right? So when you had the box that was sliding down the inclined plane, you didn't have to work this in the normal coordinate system. You could work it in a tilted coordinate system where things were simpler. And the facts were that F equals ma is true in any coordinate system. Maybe I should say any rotated coordinate system, lest you think about really weird coordinate systems. So how do you know that that's true? Who said that if F equals ma is true in one coordinate system, it's true in another coordinate system? Say again?
Was it not?
I think not. So the whole idea of vectors, which is to say really tensors, That's a surprisingly modern idea. So it turns out that that all happened a little bit before 1900. So prior to that, when people were doing vector stuff, they actually wrote out the x equation, the y equation, the z equation, one after another. And I mean, that's not too hard for F equals ma, but when you think about Maxwell's equations in non-vector form, they're really a mess. Hard to remember. Say again?
Was it Hamilton?
No. So I guess Gibbs, one of the very early American theoretical physicists, I would give a lot of credit to. I can't remember who else gets, so Heaviside gets a lot of credit for it, for electricity and magnetism. There's another name that goes with Gibbs, a European name that I can't remember. So Hamilton had kind of a different formulation, which luckily didn't catch on. So how do you know that F equals ma, if it's true in one coordinate system, it's true in another? If I tell you what this vector is in the square coordinate system, how do you figure out what it is in another coordinate system? Well, I mean, you can, of course, you know, just make your little components and figure it out, right? So you could figure out what the x component is there and what the y component is there, as opposed to what it is in this rotated coordinate system. But how do you do that in general? How could you prove stuff about any possible rotation? Matrices, right? So we have things like rotation matrices. So if you tell me what the coordinates are in one coordinate system, I can just do matrix multiplication and figure out what the coordinates are in the other coordinate system. And if F equals MA, and I want to see what that looks like in another coordinate system, all I need to do is to put that matrix in. And of course, it's going to give me that the x prime component here has to match the x component there. Pretty much guaranteed. But there's more involved than that, because, I mean, so far that would be true of most anything that the mathematicians would call a vector. There are other kind of special things that have to prove true. So, for example, the work you might remember is the dot product of the force and the displacement. And the work is what? Is the work a vector? No. It's a scalar, right? It doesn't transform. The mass here, we said that according to Newton, that was the same in every coordinate system. So if I transform F and I transform S and I do the dot product, how am I guaranteed to get exactly the same thing? How does that work out? Well, before we do that, we have to actually think about how the mathematicians would write a dot product, right? So if we have a vector or a tensor and I want to take the dot product, I mean, we know how to do this, right? AD, et cetera, add it up. But how can we make this into a mathematical statement? And kind of the trick is if we take the transpose of this column vector and now just do ordinary matrix multiplication, right, where we go like this, we're going to generate the dot product. Okay, so what the dot pro, so if we want to do a dot product, what we want to do is, mathematically, is we want to take the transpose of one of those, typically we choose the one on the left, and we want to do a normal sort of matrix multiplication with the thing that's on the right. So what does that say about what sort of rotation matrix we can use? So if we have that the W vector in the new frame, we call that W prime, if that's equal to the rotation matrix times W in the original frame, and V in the new frame is equal to a rotation matrix times V in the old frame, and I want to claim that the dot product doesn't depend on what frame I'm in, what has to be the case? So mathematically, what we need to do is we need to take the transpose of V prime and just matrix multiply it with W prime. Yeah, so these are in the rotated coordinate system, and these are in the original coordinate system, and this R is the matrix that connects them. And what should be the case is that the dot product should be invariant, right? Should be the same in any coordinate system that I choose. And I don't know if you remember this property of the, I guess I know the answer to that. I know that you don't remember this property of the transpose of two matrices, that they get written in reverse order when you take the transpose of them. So if I have this guy here and I take the transpose of it, I'm going to get V transposed R transposed. So what I've got then is that V transpose R transposed R W, that has to be the same as V transpose W for any choice of V and W. And the only way that's possible is if this is equal to the unit matrix. So it must be that the transpose of this rotation matrix is the same thing as the inverse of the matrix. It's the only thing that's going to work. Okay, so we have, according to Newton, we have things that aren't matrices, that aren't vectors, that are invariant. Time, mass, temperature, right? None of these things transform. That is to say, it's exactly the same numerical value in the rotated frame as it was in the unrotated frame. But things that are vectors, the x and y components get rearranged according to this rotation scheme. Okay, so I don't know if you remember this, but the kind of typical rotation matrix in two dimensions is this guy here. So that's going to rotate our vectors by an angle theta. Okay, so so far, you know, where's the relativity? And I promised you relativity. So you know that relativity has to do with treating space and time on kind of equal footing. But before we go there, yes. So here I've got a simple, so I'm not talking relativity yet, I'm just talking about a simple diagram that has space and time together. And since we like two-dimensional plots, we can't put all of space here, but you know, maybe y would be pointing this way and z would be pointing in some perpendicular direction to that. So I've just got these two locations. And this is all done in what I'll call the normal frame, the S frame. And notice that in order to have things have the same unit, I've multiplied my time by the speed of light. So if you wanted to think about this, this might be x in light years, this up or down? This might be x in light years, and this might be time in years, for example. More? Oh yeah, thanks. So what does the origin of somebody who's moving through space and time look like? So if we think about something that's moving, of course, its x position is going to be increasing linearly with time. We're used to switching this around, right? We're used to having time on the x-axis and y, and time on the x-axis and x on the y-axis. So maybe it looks a little bit funny, but this might be the equation of something that's moving in time. If this thing was moving really slow, then it wouldn't be making very much x progress, and it would have a line kind of like that. If this thing wasn't moving at all, it would have some sort of vertical line. So this might be the origin of our coordinate system. And one light year away from the origin, here is a similar coordinate system. And if we asked what the coordinates were of, you know, say a point like that, then, you know, what we would do is just read over the time and the space positions. Okay. Yeah, these solid lines are the ones I'm talking about. These dashed lines are things that are moving at the speed of light. And you can tell that they have the speed of light because they're at 45 degrees, and we're measuring time in, say, years and position in light years. So one light year per year would have a slope one, and it would be something like that. Okay, so I could calculate the location in the primed coordinate system. If I wanted to figure out where something was in the prime coordinate system, I could calculate where it is in the x coordinate system and then just kind of subtract off the extra distance that that guy has moved. And we would all use the same time, at least according to Galileo, because we were thinking about time as being an invariant. But this runs into trouble with electricity and magnetism because the speed of light is the same in every frame. So that means that if I calculate x squared minus c squared t squared in the original frame, or if I calculate x squared minus c squared t squared in the new frame, I'm going to get exactly the same value. That is to say that a flash of light is going to look like a circle or a sphere in any old possible coordinate system. And that's going to lead to really odd sort of things that are the topic of the Lorentz transformation. So I think historically, when you took modern, usually how the book works is they start with things like time dilation and Lorentz contraction, and they try and show those formulas work, for example, by making light clocks, right? Cases where light is bouncing back between two mirrors. And they kind of show you how it could be that the time could be different in different frames. And that's good for, I guess, introductory topics. But really, it's the Lorentz transformation that both came first historically. So Lorentz wrote down his Lorentz transformations before Einstein did his work, and are really much more fundamental than these things like time dilation and Lorentz contraction. The upshot of the Lorentz transformation is that in rotations we mixed up time and space. Excuse me, in rotations we mixed up the x coordinates and the y coordinates. For the Lorentz transformation, we're going to want to mix up the time and the position of particles in order to keep this quantity x squared minus c squared t squared a constant. Okay, so no more, if I want to figure out what the time is of this event, can I just read over what time is in the original frame. I have to somehow figure out how to calculate time in this moving frame. And that's kind of different from how this would work for position, right? So I could have all of these parallel lines, and if I had an event that was kind of like that, I can see that that's roughly, I don't know, 1.5 units over, so it has to have an x prime value that's about 1.5. So I want to have something similar. I want to be able to figure out what the times are, you know, kind of just by looking at them. So the overall idea is that I'm going to have an event, something that's happening in space and time, and I'm going to want to calculate new coordinates, new time, new x for that event, and I'm going to do that pretty much like a rotation matrix. I'm going to take this Lorentz transformation and multiply it by a 4 vector which has x, y, z, and t, and I'm going to get the new values of the event in the boosted, this coordinate frame that's going at high speed. Boost is a good shorthand for that, in this boosted coordinate system. Okay, so just moving at a constant velocity means that I have these tilted lines that correspond to the set of all possible positions that have x prime equal to 1, in contrast to the set of all possible positions that, the set of all possible positions that have x equal to 1. So how is that going to work with the boosted coordinate systems? And Minkowski, again not Einstein, is the guy who kind of got this right. So what we have here is a diagram where these lines here correspond to the particular values of x in the prime coordinate system. So if I have an event that's happening here, I can see that that happens at about 1.5 values of x prime, right? And something over here is happening at about minus x prime, minus 1/2 for x prime.
Just depending on where it is between those two.
Just depending upon where it is in this grid. So the prime positions are being given by this sort of behavior. So again, this is the origin. So this set of points is the set of points that is 1 unit ahead of the origin. So I would naturally call that x prime equals 1. What's new and different is the fact that the set of points that are at the same time is going to be tilted, just as the set of points that were x prime equals 0 is tilted. So before, the set of all points that was x equals 0 was this, and now the set of all points that is x prime equals 0 is that. Before, the set of all points that were time equals 0 is this, now the set of all points that are time prime equal to 0 are this. So we're going to have different coordinate values for both time and space. And if we want to calculate numerically, all we have to do is to plug into the Lorentz transformation. And the formula for the Lorentz transformation is in the handout. I won't bother to, and it's also nicely calculatable in Mathematica. So an event like, this, according to the original observer, that happens at x equals 0 and time maybe what? 1.3, something like that. According to the moving observer, this happened at a prime position that is going to be negative, right? So I have to go down this way. So it has a negative x prime, negative 1/2, say, for x prime. And it has a time that we can calculate by how far we go on this diagonal. So it has a time that is also, I guess, not that different from 1.5, right? So this would be the set of points that is t prime equals 0. This is the set of point that is t prime equal to 1. And this is the set of points that's t prime equal to 2. Okay, so every point on the plane, every place, every event in the universe has x, y, z, and time coordinates. And we transform between them according to the Lorentz transformation. Say again?
What are those
dotted
lines?
So the dash lines, of course, are light. And now you're asking me about these lighter dash lines. how do we figure out how to put units, size, on these coordinates? I mean, how do I know that, this is x prime equals to 1 as opposed to a line like that being x prime equal to 1? Right, so any line like this has to be x prime equals a constant, but what constant? How do I put values on my grid? And there's kind of an easy trick to do this, and that is that we know that light has to look like light in any frame of reference. So x squared minus ct squared has to be invariant in any coordinate system, just like the dot product has to be invariant in any coordinate system. And so what this dashed line corresponds to is it corresponds to the equation that x squared minus ct squared is equal to 1. And therefore, this point here has to so that point corresponds to t prime being 0, and therefore it has to correspond to x prime being 1. So, what's let me back up for a little bit. What's the formula for the dot product in the normal coordinate system, right? So in the normal coordinate system we have, and let me just do it in two dimensions so that it's fast. So that's what the dot product is in one coordinate system. What's the formula for it in another coordinate system? Well, it's exactly the same, right? So it's just we take the components of those vectors in their new values, and we get the same thing because the form is invariant. So the set of points that is x squared minus ct squared equal to 1, what does that set of points look like in the prime frame? Well, it looks exactly the same. So if I ask where t prime is equal to 0, I can discover where x prime is equal to 1. Okay, so this set of points is the set of points where in any coordinate system, x squared minus ct squared is going to equal to 1. And so automatically, this point here corresponds to x prime being 1. It certainly doesn't correspond to x being 1, right? Because this thing is not a, x being 1 would require this to be a straight line, right? So this is x being 1 and time being 0. This is x prime being 1 and t prime being 0.
How did you know that it was equal to 1?
I chose it. I can graph it equal to anything I wanted to, and in fact, this next one, I've graphed the set of points where it's equal to 2. 2 squared, I guess. So for any point on this curve in any coordinate system, if I take x squared minus ct squared, I'm going to get 1. Say again? So for this point here, I know that t is equal to 0, and so x has to equal 1. For this point here, because it's on this diagonal line, I know that t prime is 0. And therefore, x prime has to equal 1. Okay, and similarly, this point here has to correspond to x prime being equal to 2.
When you wrote down the equation, you just said x squared minus ct squared. Is that also x prime squared minus ct?
So it's invariant, right? This equation looks the same, just like the formula for a dot product looks the same in any coordinate system. Okay. The formula is invariant. So in any form, in any coordinate system, it's going to look exactly the same. So we also have the same thing for these time axes. So this spot here corresponds to t being equal to 1 and x being equal to 0. And this spot here corresponds to T prime being equal to 1 and X prime being equal to 0. X prime equals 0 because this is the line of the origin, right? The moving origin. Say again?
Because it's x squared minus ct squared, doesn't that mean we need an I?
Yeah, so these things are actually ct squared minus x squared. Or I guess I could say just as well, instead of this having being 1, it's minus 1. So there are different branches of these hyperbole. Okay, so Lorentz contraction. So Lorentz contraction says that if you're moving at high speed, if you watch somebody moving at high speed, their meter sticks seem short. How can we reconcile that with this picture? Okay, so here's one end of the meter stick, and here's the other end of the meter stick. So these set of points, the left-hand end of the meter stick is moving through space and time. And so there it is. Here's where it was earlier. Here's where it is later. It happens that at time equals 0, the origin of the left-hand side of the meter stick is at the origin. Here's the set of points that is the right-hand side of the meter stick. It's at different places at different times. How long is the meter stick? Well, no, it's not. It's less than a meter. How do we measure the size of a meter stick? Well, we measure where the two ends are at the same time, and we just subtract the differences. So this meter stick is here. The right-hand side of the meter stick is there at time equals 0, not t prime equals 0, but at time equals 0. And the left-hand side of the meter stick is there at t equals 0. And so the distance, the separation between those two points, is less than 1. The meter stick looks contracted. So you're saying, how do I know that it is shorter?
Oh, no, I don't have to believe it looks shorter, but is that the points we're talking
about? What points
are we comparing? So we're comparing the where the ends of the meter stick are at time equals 0. Time equals 0 is this line here. So we're comparing these two points. So this meter stick is moving. Here's the left-hand side moving. Here's the right-hand side moving.
So in its frame of reference, is that line that
so how big it is in its own reference frame, what you're going to do is you're going to measure where both sides of the stick are at t prime equals 0. Right? At the same time, you're going to ask where your meter sticks are. And that's where those two points are. And we already established that this one was x prime equal 1, and this one is x prime equal 0. So this meter stick has a length of 1 in its own rest frame. But this was where the intersection was with the unprime frame, and you can see that it's shorter in the unprime frame than it was before. It's less than 1.
Why isn't that a dotted line in that? So what's the dot on the solid line?
Which color dot?
The dot on the solid line.
So these two pink dots have to do with measuring the size of the meter stick in the unprime frame, in the original frame.
And to
do that, we're going to measure where it is at t equals 0, which is this set of points. So here's the whole set of points for the left-hand side. Here's the whole set of points for the right-hand side. The two times where the ends of the meter stick are at t equals 0 are there and there. And that's less than 1, right? Because here's where 1 is. It's out here. So it's a meter stick that has length 1 if we measure it at t prime equals 0. If we measure it at t equals 0, we get a different size. If we look at the next one over, you can see maybe a more extreme case. So you remember that these lines are the speed of the origin, and as they get closer and closer to the diagonal, we're getting closer and closer to the speed of light. So here and here are two points that are separated by x prime equal 1. I'm sorry I've switched colors on us, but I did. Here and here are the two sides separated at t equals 0. And you can see that this distance, the length of the rod as measured by the unprime frame, is substantially less than 1. Okay. So the set of all, well, so one is different things in different places, right? Just as, here's where the rod is at t prime equals 0, and it has length 1. And we know it has length 1 is because it's on this curve, which is x squared minus t squared equals 1. And we know that t prime is equal to 0, so x prime has to be 1. Okay, so that's length contraction. We have seen that something that has fixed size in the prime frame looks shorter in the unprime frame. How about time dilation? So how long is one tick in the prime frame? Well, so this spot here, that is t prime equal 1. Why is it t prime equals 1? Because it's on this curve. No. The dash line. So these points here, those are the set of points that are ct squared minus x squared equals 1. And therefore, this spot here, which has x prime equals 0, has to have t prime equal 1. And you can see that according to our coordinate system, this time is more than 1 unit. It's taken more than 1 second in order to tick off that time. And again, if we switch to the more extreme velocity, it's more evident. So here's the origin. Here is the spot that is t prime equals to 1, and it's way more than 1 time.
So,
so if we were talking about an even more faster moving coordinate system, then these lines would be even closer to the speed of light, and say a point like that might correspond to one tick in that moving frame.
But I mean, like, all of those parabolas are equal 1, right?
Yeah, so I can find a frame in which any one of these points corresponds to t prime being 1. And depending upon how fast I'm moving, right, as I move faster and faster and faster, the frame that corresponds to t prime is 1 is moving out this way. So I hope it's clear that the fact that we're measuring different times is kind of the key to what's happening. So here's kind of another take on all of this process. So what are all of these funny pictures? So the circled number is the time reading on a digital clock. And even though these times all look different, they're actually the same time according to the guy who's moving with these clocks. So notice that we're in what's called the center of mass frame, right? We have one frame that's going this way, one frame that's going that way, and we've picked a frame that is symmetric. Okay?
No.
No.
What? Okay.
So if we look at So let's try and look at what T prime's clocks look like according to the unprimed frame. Okay, so this spot here corresponds to T prime, and let's do this at our time of T equals 0. So at the same time, let's look at all of the clocks in the prime coordinate system. So we're going to see this clock that's reading 0. What is this clock going to read? Negative? So remember that the time lines correspond to going this way and the space lines correspond to this. So this spot here is going to correspond to, I don't know, something like a half, something like plus a half. And this one here is going to correspond to something like plus 1. On the other hand, as we go this way, we're talking about negative times. So when we see a set of clocks that are going this way, we don't see them as all reading the same time. They're not synchronized. Right? So if we just look at the top line, here are these clocks that are going this way at high speed. This one is reading negative numbers. This one's reading positive numbers. The bottom frame is going the other way, so exactly the kind of opposite reverse happens. The clocks that are ahead of the train, they're going to read negative numbers, and the clocks that are behind are going to read positive numbers. So moving clocks do not look like they're synchronized. And the reason they don't look like synchronized is because the line that is synchronized is tilted in this coordinate system. What we say is an instant is not the same thing as what this guy says is an instant. They're different things. So I'm going to claim that the bottom guy, I guess that's the unprimed frame, he will measure that this whole, that, well, I guess three of these units are actually the same size as the distance between B and C. He will see Lorentz contraction. Simultaneously, the prime frame will claim that this distance between D and E is the same, excuse me, I have this backwards, that this whole distance between these three guys is the same distance as between two of these things. They both are going to see the other guy as being Lorentz contracted. So how is that going to work? Well, we have to make our measurements at the same time. So let's talk about the top set of the diagram, and let's measure at time equals 1. So at time equals 1, we see that B is next to B prime, and at time equals 1, we see that E is next to C.
So these are different
statements. These are different pictures. And this is in a third coordinate system. So we have one set of coordinates that are moving this way. We have another set of coordinates that are moving that way. And in order to get this in order to see the symmetry, we've decided to view this in a coordinate system that's halfway between those two. So what we see is these guys going like that.
Okay.
But we can see their clocks, and we can see what measurements they're going to make. And we see that they've decided to make a measurement of where everything is at t equals 1. And according to the top guy, he says at t equals 1, B is next to B prime. And at t equals 1, that same instant, E is next to C. So all of this stuff between B and E has to be between B prime and C prime. So it has been contracted down by a factor of a third. And let's do the same sort of thing according to the bottom frame. So according to the bottom frame, let's do the same measurement at time equals 1. According to the bottom guy, at time equals 1, D prime is right next to him, and at the same instant, A prime is next to C. So this whole segment, at the same instant, is between C and D. Okay. So let's take a look at time dilation and how that could be mutual. How long does it take how long does it take to tick off 1 second in the prime frame according to the unprime frame? So here we have a time equals 1 and the time is minus 1. 4 seconds later, 3 seconds later, 1 unit has clicked off. Do we buy that? So we look at a clock in the top frame, it's reading 1 currently, and the time in our frame is minus 1. How, when we see that same clock reading 2, our time says it's 2. So it takes 3 seconds for 1 second to occur in the top frame. Okay, so vice versa, if we look at, say, this clock here, E, it's reading 2 at what we think is time equals minus 2. When we see it reading 3, our clocks are now reading 2. So it took 3 seconds, according to the top guy, for this clock to click off 1 second. Okay, so I don't know, what I hope I've made you a believer about is that the lack of synchronization, the fact that at the same time means different things. And so when we see people making measurements at the same time, it's going to mean different things according to which observer we're talking about. Let's go back to this guy and so we talked about how the prime frame looks small according to the unprime frame. How about the reverse? If we look at two sticks, if we look at the world line of, so here we have a meter stick that's at rest in the unprime coordinate system, how do we come to the conclusion that thing is bigger than 1 unit? Well, we measure its position at the same time. At the same time meaning t prime equals 0. And at t prime equals 0, the blue end of that rod is inside of what we decided was x prime equals 1. So it's contracted. So let's switch to the more dramatic one and be somewhat careful about our lines. So here's the future of x equals 1. And here is the instant now of t prime equals 0. Here's 1 unit. And this thing is inside of 1 unit. Yeah, I said exactly the reverse according to which frame of reference I was talking about. So before we were talking about a meter stick that was at rest in the T prime frame looking short, and now we're talking about, according to the unprimed observer, now we're talking about a measurement that the primed observer makes of a meter stick that's at rest in this coordinate system. So
you can see that the blue one sitting still has the two pinned dots.
So the two ends of the stick at rest, of course, have horizontal lines. They're not moving. When he makes a measurement at T prime equals zero, he finds here and here. And this distance is less than one.
So when you're moving and things are at rest, they look short.
Say that again. Yeah, so I'll say yes to that. I'll say yes to that, but I want to change around the phraseology of it. There isn't absolute rest, so you can't talk about somebody who is at absolute rest. If you're in a car, those trees are going by at high speed. So moving trees are shrunken. Yes. Yes. Because I don't think I'm moving. So you have to see what you would see, right? If you looked out the window, you would see trees moving at high speed.
Yeah.
The guy who's sitting under the apple tree sees the train going by at high speed. And they both see the same thing. The moving guy is shrunken. The moving guy's clocks are running slow. And what's kind of hard to believe is that those could both simultaneously be true. I mean, how can A say B's meter stick is short and B say A's meter stick is short? It doesn't. One of those maybe you could buy, but buying both at the same time seems problematic. And the way that it has become possible is by what we mean by the length depends on the concept of at the same time. And at the same time are different points. So when the unprime coordinate system measures the spot of his rod, he uses those two points. Whereas the moving guy uses those two points. This guy says the meter stick is 1 meter long. This guy says, no, it's way short. Yes, yeah. Yep, it's just not as dramatic. It's hard to see that if I guess I wasn't all that careful, but this blue line is inside of where that dot is.
I think you said it
wrong. I might have.
So I have a question about like the contraction and like what its consequences would be for like fitting if there are two babies that can't hold them. Like if you had some sort of container that would close the back and assume something inside of it, and then had something that should fit in there, but it didn't fit too well in this
thing. Yeah.
And then it's stopped and stuff inside of it.
So that's the classic problem. So here I've got my my little shed that's only 1 meter wide. But let me put two doors on my shed. And here I've got my pole vault stick. And I claim if that pole vault stick is moving fast enough, it is Lorentz contracted enough to fit into my little shed. And I can close both of these doors at the same time. And the meter stick is totally in there. What does that look like according to a guy that's on the pole vault? Well, it's got to look really weird because, of course, the shed now looks Lorentz contracted, right? It's really tiny. So it's not a matter of 1 meter and 5 meters. It's a matter of a fifth of a meter and 5 meters. So it looks like there's absolutely no hope. But what this guy is going to see is the shed comes flying towards him at high speed. And what happens is when it's in about in this position, the door on this side closes and then opens. And then sometime later, this door closes and opens. And obviously, I was never inside the shed at one time, right? You were just playing games with where you, when you opened and closed the door.
Why are they open?
Okay, so now let me close the doors. and then see what happens. First, I wanted to leave them both open. So if I close this door and I make this really strong so it can't go through, obviously what's going to happen is there's going to be a collision. But I can still ask, does this end of the pole vault end up in the shed or not? I mean, according to the guy on the pole vault, it looks hopeless, right? Because this little tiny shed, I'm running into it at high speed. How could this end possibly end up inside that shed? But it turns out you can show that it's impossible to affect things at this end of the pole vault unless light could have propagated from one end to the other. And it turns out that you can do the calculations. It is impossible to stop this end of the pole vault until it's inside the shed. So either way, you end up with this crumpled pole vault. But as a matter of fact, this end did end up inside the shed when the final door was closed.
So then, it would slow down. Assuming it doesn't collapse in the wall, it's rigid enough.
Okay, so this word rigid is impossible. So I'm sure you think that if I push this end of a meter stick 1 meter, 1 inch, this end also moves 1 inch at the same time. And it doesn't. Yeah, it takes some time, the speed of sound for real materials, in order for this end to be affected by stuff you do at that end. So, as I say, it turns out it is impossible to stop this, because light can't reach it, it's impossible for this end of the meter stick to be stopped until it's inside of the shed. And so we all agree, crumpled meter stick, crumpled pole vault, inside of shed. So the big handout is there to kind of show you how you would use the Mathematica stuff. You're not going to do the homework from there. I'll put some online homework for you to do.